and welcome to the Trust Your Body Project. Trust Your Body Project is a podcast and social media movement designed to help you heal, eat, and create space for the things that truly matter. I'm your host, Whitney Catalano. I'm an anti-diet, health at every size registered dietitian, helping you stop dieting, make peace with your body, and take the power back from your inner bully. Welcome to episode number 33. On today's episode, we are talking to Jake Lenardin, who is break.binge.eating on Instagram. He is an Australian binge eating researcher, and so I wanted to have him come on the podcast and talk about binge eating because, hey, we got to know about this stuff, right? Like, I know a lot of you struggle with it and you're interested in learning more about it. And I feel like there's a lot of misconceptions about what binge eating is, what it isn't. There's also just some differences in the way that different people address binge eating or go about treating it, because there's sort of clinical binge eating and then there's subjective binge eating. And he's going to explain all of that. And we had a really interesting conversation because it definitely caused me to question the way that I go about helping people. And you know, ultimately, I've found a lot of success in the strategies that I use and the way that I go about it. And so that's something that I've been testing out in my most recent group coaching program, Binge to Food Freedom, which I will be changing the name of in 2020. Oh my gosh, next year's 2020 already. This is crazy. anyway, I got distracted. But yeah, so Jake's actually helping me test out the effectiveness of my group program, and I'm going to continue to retest as I change it and develop it over the years. So I'm really excited about that and was just so grateful to have this conversation with him. So I hope you learn a lot. Definitely go follow him on Instagram. He's freaking awesome. He posts some really great, informative content and just explains things really well, in my opinion. So yeah, I hope you like that. But before we get into the interview and, you know, all the juicy goodness of binge eating, I don't know if anyone would describe it like that except for maybe me, because I like this stuff. What can I say? Let's talk about the fact that this podcast is brought to you by Club TYB. So like I explained last week, and I'll keep it much shorter this time, Club TYB is your food freedom family. So if you have a lot of friends and family who are dieting or just don't understand what you're going through, or maybe you haven't even talked to anyone about this yet, Club TYB is the place that you can go get support to talk some of this stuff out and to continue your learning with me and all the experts who have graciously agreed to come in and do interviews within the membership site. So we've got lots of stuff going on in Club TYB. We've got weekly journaling prompts, affirmations, weekly wins, monthly calls, whether it's a deep dive topic or a guest lecture. I mean, we do one of each every month. So this month coming up, like I said, we are having Julie Duffy Dillon come in and talk about PCOS a little bit more in detail than what we had talked about on my podcast. And yeah, just a lot of really exciting stuff. I think this month I'm also going to be talking about setting intentions for the new year as opposed to New Year's resolutions and how to navigate all the diet talk in the new year. So we're really going to be focusing on that in December because I want to make sure you all are equipped for the chaos that is January. So if you're interested in joining Club TYB and finding a community of compassionate and amazing people who are dedicated to healing their relationship with food, head on over to whitneycatalano.com/club-TYB. That's whitneycatalano.com/club-TYB to learn more. And if you join at the 6-month level, you will also get my course, The 5 Pillars of Food Freedom. It's a mini course to you for free. So you're saving literally $75 by joining at the 6-month option. You're going to get all this foundational information. Or if you don't want to join the membership, you can just go buy that course by itself. It's $49 and it'll save you hours of listening to podcasts and like searching the internet for information, because it's everything that you need to know as a foundation for your journey to food freedom, just all in one place. It'll take you less than an afternoon to get through this course and it will answer a lot of your foundational questions and give you some really actionable steps to start healing your relationship with food. So you can join the 6-month option, whitneycatalano.com/club-TYB, in order to get that for free and save $75, which always an amazing opportunity to save some money. Or you can head on over to whitneycatalano.com/pillars to learn more about the 5 Pillars of Food Freedom if you're just interested in starting there. That's cool too. like I mentioned in the last episode, if you are wanting to work one-on-one with me, I'm going to be capping my one-on-one coaching spots in the first half of next year as a way of creating space for the other things that I'm going to be announcing soon. So head on over to whitneycatalano.com/book if you want to apply for a clarity call with me. In case you're new here, I offer free one-on-one clarity calls to people who apply and who I feel like are going to be a good fit, or I will be a good fit to help you where you're at. I'll reach out to you after I read your application. We can set up a clarity call. We talk for an hour about everything that is going on in your life. And then, you know, if you have questions about coaching, we can talk about that. But really the point of these calls is to serve you and to, you know, show up for you wherever you're at. And for you to get a sense of what my coaching is like and how maybe I can help you even just create a vision for yourself of like, where do you want to be in 6 months? And what do you want it to look like? And how are these things currently getting in your way of living your life right now? Because that's really what dieting does, is it gets in the way of us living our lives. It keeps our lives really small. So if you've been thinking about working one-on-one with me, or maybe you're just now hearing about it, I highly recommend you apply for a call as soon as possible, because I will be capping the number of coaching clients that I take on, and you don't want to miss out on that opportunity. So whitneycatalano.com/book, and I promise I'll stop being so mysterious about all of this fairly soon and actually explain what's going on, but just not yet, because I don't know, it's fun. All right. Thank you to everyone who's been leaving reviews on Apple Podcasts. I know I haven't read the names of the people who have left reviews in a while, and I will start doing that in the new season. I'm really just trying to like get done with this season and get all the backlogged interviews that I've been talking about obsessively for the past, you know, year. I'm trying to get all of that done so I have my schedule for the rest of the year, and we're just doing it. And then I'm going to go back. I'm going to figure out where I left off in the names and then go back and catch up on all of that. So please, please, please keep leaving reviews on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. Please keep sending my podcast to your friends. Honestly, the reviews really help, because people who might not have otherwise have heard of me, don't follow me on Instagram, or maybe don't even know what the anti-diet health at every size movement is, have an opportunity to find me if I rank in some of these charts, some of the categories. So I would definitely appreciate any sort of review or promotion or sending it to your friends, because I'm just trying to get this message out there and help people avoid the trap of dieting or heal their relationship with food, so that you all can get to doing the things that actually freaking matter in the world, besides just making ourselves smaller and taking up less space. Because you gotta say, it just doesn't matter. Like, I really wish this obsession with thinness would just be over by now. I'm sure, you know, that's not exactly a revolutionary sentiment, although I guess in some audiences it is, but amongst the anti-diet or body positive communities, you know, that's a pretty standard sentiment that goes around of just like, why do we care so much? But for real, why do we freaking care so much? And can we start to take down diet culture so that we can focus on other stuff? That's all I want. So yeah, that was a long-winded way of saying go leave reviews on Apple Podcasts. Thanks. Okay, I think that's it for announcements. For those of you who are just tuning in, and maybe you are just listening to this episode because you saw binge eating and you feel like you might struggle with it or you want to learn more, I have another episode way back. It's called Why You Can't Stop Eating. So in that episode, I talk about the different kinds of restriction, which is actually something I mentioned in this interview with Jake. So if you're like, what does she mean? I have a literal whole episode on that. And then in the 5 Pillars of Food Freedom course, one of the things that I talk about pretty extensively is like why binge eating is a response to restriction and deprivation, and what to do about it if you're struggling with it, like what first steps that you can take in order to heal your binge eating. So if you are struggling with binge eating and you're looking for more information, but you don't really know where to go, or if you're ready to commit or anything like that, you just need to learn more. The 5 Pillars of Food Freedom course that I mentioned before is a really great way to get the foundational information for a pretty low cost. So $49 for like all of that information. It'll save you a lot of time, stress, and confusion, because I just lay it out exactly what you need and explain, you know, what to start doing about it. So WhitneyCatalano.com/pillars. Okay, I'm done. Seriously, we're getting into the interview. Let's do this. Okay, so today we are talking to Dr. Jake Lenardin. He is a research fellow and a psychology lecturer at Deakin University in Melbourne. Did I get that right?
Correct.
Okay, so the reason why I wanted to have Dr. Jake, can I call you Dr. Jake?
Just Jake. just Jake is completely fine.
Okay, so the reason why I wanted to have you on, for anyone listening, the reason why I wanted to have him on is because you specialize, so you are on Instagram at what, break.binge.eating, is that what it is?
Yes, break the that's binge? Right.
No.
Break binge eating.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you specialize in doing research around binge eating, around body dissatisfaction. And so I wanted to get your expert opinion because you've done a lot of research. You have over 35 peer-reviewed scientific research articles. So that's huge.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'm curious how you got into this work.
Yeah, so that's always that's the typical question that we get asked when we go into this line of work. And there's always a personal kind of experience involved in these things, whether that be, you know, someone working in mental health. So I guess the straightforward answer is that these particular issues of body image and you know, restrictive eating patterns resonate with a lot of people, including myself, particularly when I was younger, where, you know, where I used to go to the gym quite a lot and I used to, you know, try to achieve a particular physique. And the way to do that was via these methods of, you know, dieting, watching what you eat, calorie counting, blah, blah, all that kind of stuff. And then I just kind of, you know, realized that it wasn't kind of helping my well-being, and it wasn't making me feel as good as I should have been. So it just sparked a little bit of interest because I was doing psychology as an undergraduate degree at the time. And then I, you know, from a personal experience and then later on, I started to realize, oh, this area is really cool and interesting, not only because, you know, I can relate to some of the things that I'm studying, but also that I know so many other people as well that are going through things like this too. And as a result, I thought it'd be better to try to not only understand it a bit more, but address it, try to find ways in which we can address these particular issues. And it ranges from a bunch of different things, so things like, you know, binge eating, being simply unhappy with your body weight and shape, and also some, you know, really dangerous dieting behaviors too. So that's the kind of the quick answer. You know, there's a little bit of personal experience involved. And then it just kind of snowballed from that. I developed interest in it. I started to do a little bit of research onto it. And then I realized, hey, this is really cool. And I kept going and going and going. And it's a really topical area of interest now. And I think the tide is shifting in how we kind of approach and view these strict dietary practices and that, you know, the typical thin ideal that women kind of, a lot of women try to achieve, and also the muscular ideal that a lot of men achieve. So that just kind of spiraled from that. It was just an interest. And now I'm stuck in the area, which is stuck, meaning it's a good thing. And I don't plan on going anywhere for a long time.
Yeah, I hope you don't, because we always need more researchers looking into this stuff. Mm. And especially because you seem to be informed about like stigma and the thin ideal and not trying to solve it from a perspective of we should help people break binge eating, you know, so they can be thin, because that's,
yeah, exactly.
Unfortunately, a lot of bias is in eating disorder treatment, is in, you know, eating disorder conversations, and that does a huge disservice to the people going through it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that it's the cause of the binge eating. So if we're trying to address the binge itself with the perspective that, you know, oh yeah, you might be able to lose that weight if you stop your binge eating, but no, that's actually just fueling it even further. So we might be able to stop it temporarily, but if we don't address the underlying things, then there's a really high probability that the person will go back into those unhelpful eating habits as well. So we certainly want to address the associated, you know, body image concerns, because if we can, you know, if we're able to effectively, I guess, address those things, and when we're you know, a quarter of a way there towards, you know, breaking that full binge eating cycle.
Absolutely. So what do you think, I mean, on that topic, what do you think that is one of the biggest misconceptions around binge eating?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a hard question. I think one of the biggest misconceptions around binge eating is the inability to distinguish. So I think there are a couple misconceptions, and I think one of them is the inability to distinguish between binge eating versus general overeating. Mm. I think that's what a lot of people get confused with, is people, I would dare say everyone in life overeats from time to time, but then not everyone binge eats. So if you actually look at the statistics, there's only a small percent of the population that binge eats. There's a ton of people that do it, but if we're taking into account worldwide, globally, the number of people, it's just a minority of people that binge eat. Whereas I would, you know, argue that probably everyone has overeaten in their life. So distinguishing between those two types is very important, and it's a misconception because people kind of conflate the two. So we need to differentiate the two, and the way in which we can differentiate the two is a couple of characteristics of binge eating that really markedly differ from overeating. And the core characteristic is that with binge eating, there's a sense of, you know, the person's unable to control their behavior. So people describe it as in a trance. They're in a trance and they're just, you know, even if they wanted to stop, they just couldn't. They just keep, you know, overindulging on these particular foods, as well as certain other characteristics as well. So things like people that binge eat experience a lot of shame. It's much more pronounced or profound than people who overeat. People who overeat will feel guilty for a very short period of time. They may feel guilty. They may feel like, oh, did I really need to do that? But then it stops very quickly. Whereas people with binge eat, those associated mental health problems last for much longer. So that's one important misconception that people have, just clearly delineating between the two. And the other is the sex distribution between of binge eating. So there's common misconception that females tend to, you know, significantly outweigh the number of men who binge eat. But we know more recently that gap is significantly closing, almost to the case where there's an equal distribution. It's almost 50-50 at the moment. So we're seeing a really big rise in the number of boys and men who are starting to have these disordered eating patterns. But the traditional view that it was just females that get affected by this, now we're hopefully giving more awareness that, hey, actually, both men and women alike are really suffering with these particular types of issues. So I think they're the two core misconceptions about binge eating.
So why do you think that is? Why do you think that there is this misconception that only women binge eat?
Yeah, well, that's a good one. So I think the misconception comes down to the fact that when we think about eating disorders, we think about women. That's traditionally how it's viewed. And men have been largely neglected in this area of research. So if you look at research in the, you know, in the 90s and in the early 2000s, it was just the studies that people conducted were just on women. We knew nothing about men at all. And as a result, it's just had that snowball effect where, you know, the people that started this work have just been focusing on and talking about women, and it's just kind of transcended towards, you know, the community that, you know, eating disorders affect only women from affluent countries or developed countries, and, you know, have a certain good socioeconomic status, I guess. And now we know that the tide is certainly changing. But I think, yeah, to answer your question more simply, I think it's just that's how we think about it, and it's just kept going. And now it's, like I said, it's changing quite a bit.
Yeah. I would also say there's a little bit of a cultural attitude that what might be considered, and I only, you know, really noticed this, and that speaks to my gender being represented or whatever, but I only really noticed this because of my male clients who point out that their binge eating behaviors tend to be very normalized. It's just like, oh, you're a guy, you eat a lot. Yeah. And they're
right,
like, this doesn't feel normal. Like, whereas women, there's this like intense shame around it of the desire for thinness and all this stuff. It's just not, there's these really like culturally polarizing attitudes around gender that is very interesting.
Yeah, that's actually an excellent point that I didn't even think about. And you know, when you think about it, it's so true because women on average, you know, when they have these particular problems, they're striving for a lean figure, whereas men are striving for muscular. So in order to achieve, you know, big bulky muscles, you need to eat a lot and to eat a lot. So people may find it hard to distinguish, like you said, that's normal because they're eating a lot. They're actually trying to achieve their goal. So yeah, like that's great. That's normal. And it's normalized. But in fact, the people that are doing it are realizing, like, I can't take this anymore. This is really affecting me.
Yeah. You know, I thought it was interesting what you were talking about with the distinguishing between overeating and binge eating, because I do find that a lot of people, whether it's on Instagram or my clients, just don't know the difference, because the word binge eating, and I'm part of the problem, right? The word binge eating is sort of marketed in this way, or we're trying to target people who do struggle with binge eating. But now it's kind of this thing where everyone thinks they struggle with binge eating. And actually, when it comes down to it, and I'm working with clients, maybe they're struggling with, you know, compulsive overeating, maybe they're struggling with emotional eating, but it's not, I wouldn't classify. And when I explain the difference between all of them, like, they even say, you know, oh, I actually don't think that that is binge eating, or I don't know if I've ever experienced binge eating, because it is that trance-like mindset that you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's interesting that you raise that, because what we generally see is that people who, you know, who talk about or self-report binge eating really overestimate and exaggerate the extent to which they binge eat. It's not until we actually sit down with them and have an interview, like a semi-structured interview, to assess their binge eating, then they do realize that, hey, this actually doesn't fit the criteria for binge eating, or it might just represent another different form of pathological eating, like emotional eating and overeating. So yeah, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, that what defines binge eating is a couple of things. The first one is a really consumption of a really unusually large amount of food in a short period of time. And people then generally ask the question, well, what do you mean? What's a large amount of food? We don't have a clear-cut answer for what a large amount of food is, but the guidelines that we tend to follow, because we all need some sort of structure and guidelines to this, the guidelines we tend to follow is that it's generally around 50 calories or more in a sitting within the space of around an hour to 2 hours. That's what we usually define as a big, large amount of food in a short period of time. But the important feature is that with or in addition to that, the person, as we mentioned, experiences that lack of control, so their inability to control themselves. But then you talk to people and they realize, well, I do sometimes experience loss of control, but I don't eat that much food. So they would eat, some people just physically can't eat that huge amount of food that we talked about. So they still eat it, but they still feel like, oh, you know, I just can't control myself at the moment. So then what we've done is we've tried to distinguish between two different types of episodes. The one being the objective episode, which is the one I just spoke about earlier with that really large amount, you know, an abundance of food. But there's also another episode we talk about, which is the subjective binge eating episodes, where this is almost the same thing as the objective, but the difference is that the person doesn't actually eat all that much food. They still have the loss of control component. So there's two different types of binge eating episodes, I guess, and the distinguishing feature is the amount of food consumed. But both of them are characterized by that loss of control. And what's really interesting is that there've been a couple of studies like comparing the two episodes of binge eating in people, and they've found that both people who either engage in the objective or the subjective binge eating have equally have a similar degree of impairment in their functioning. So their psychological, their mental health, their social functioning, their interpersonal functioning, even their physical health, the degree of impairment is comparable across the groups, which is kind of suggesting that it's not the eating per se that's the issue that's causing these problems. It's the cognitive component of the inability to control the self. So I think that's really interesting and important to kind of distinguish and decipher.
I like want to just reiterate that for anyone listening who didn't quite catch that or needs it reiterated for the people in the back, is that it's not really about the amount of food as much as it's about the mindset, right?
That's right.
The attitude, the shame associated with it, that feeling of out of control, whether you're eating a large amount of food or not, the emotions around it and the mindset around it is what makes it a binge.
That's right. It's the cognitive component that you just mentioned. Absolutely.
And that's one of those things that I think is so important, because I know that there's a lot of resistance around getting help or being like, am I sick enough? That kind of attitude of, am I sick enough to get help? You know, it's not that much food or whatever, you know, I don't feel sick enough, like all this stuff. But it's like, if you're experiencing the mental and emotional components of it, you should probably, if you're even asking the question, like, am I sick enough to be getting help? Probably.
That's an indication, isn't it? Like if you're thinking about that stuff, then it's probably suggesting that, well, I might need to do something about this. And we need to do our best to eliminate any shame associated with mental health, help seeking. Yeah, I like personally myself can't see how it can be a stigma for someone. Like for me, if I'm feeling, you know, down, I'll go get help. Like it's no issue for me, but people, you know, are really afraid to seek help. And it's hopefully it's people like us that have, you know, the platform to talk about these things can actually spread the word that, you know what, it's actually okay to go and get help and see a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a dietitian, a nutritionist. It's actually okay to do that. So I think there's a little bit of a shift going, but I think there's still a really long way to go before we can reduce or eliminate that stigma of mental health help seeking.
Yeah. And I know that big conversation that's happening right now amongst, you know, people of color is that the stigma in communities, like with specifically in America, I don't know if this is elsewhere. I just know like what is happening in America, but there are more conversations of like amongst with TV shows and in the media about how people of color, like reducing that stigma, they face a much bigger stigma than white people in America do around mental health for a number of different cultural reasons and whatever. You know, there's so many different reasons and factors going into that, but there definitely is a push to reduce the stigma around it. Do we have work to do? Absolutely. But
Yeah, I think we're on the right track though, because I think there is some evidence to show that help seeking has increased over time as a result of the more awareness, you know, the mental health literacy, education around these issues. So, but yes, the fight is still going and hopefully, you know, we can make a small contribution to that.
Yeah. So let's talk about what causes binge eating, because obviously you said, or you mentioned the pursuit of thinness.
Yeah.
And I know the research talks a lot about dietary restraint. So I was hoping that you could maybe explain that a little bit more, explain maybe why, because I do get this question a lot, why some people develop binge eating when others don't.
Yeah, yeah.
As a result of dieting. Yeah.
Yeah. So dieting is the strongest risk factor for developing binge eating. So that's unequivocal. Like we've shown that, you know, there have been an abundance of different, you know, meta-analyses showing linking dieting to binge eating. Yes, there is some contradictory evidence to the suggesting that it's not the case. But if we need to take a more, you know, nuanced approach to this and really focusing on why and under what conditions dieting then leads to binge eating. So we've established that there is a relationship going on between the two. So then the question is, well, okay, there's a relationship, but not everyone who diets goes on to develop an eating disorder or goes on to develop binge eating. So why is that? So then we need to understand, okay, what types of people, quote unquote, are developing these issues. And we've got a bit of leeway into understanding why this is. And what it is it's the diet itself that people go on that is contributing to binge eating. And what I mean by that, people who diet in an extreme and an inflexible fashion tend to go on to develop binge eating relative to people who take a more flexible or relaxed approach to dieting. So what do I actually mean by that? Well, the rigid, let's just call it the rigid diet approach. That's when people essentially have all of these different diet rules that they've come up with. They've got a bunch of different food rules that dictates to them what they're allowed to eat, when they're allowed to eat, and how much they're allowed to eat. I like to conceptualize that into three categories of diet rules. The what rules, which is basically, that's when I'm sure your clients come to you all the time saying, I've got a list of forbidden foods that I will never allow myself to eat. You know, I've got chocolate, cake, pasta. Some people even have almonds on those lists. Like, I will never eat those forbidden foods. They're the what rules. And the reason why they're forbidden is a couple of reasons. One is that they are believed to cause weight gain. That people are scared because they'll cause weight. And the second is that they're a major binge trigger. Mm-hmm. People eat one small taste of that and they're like, oh, I just need some more. So they go. The next one is the when rules, and those rules dictate when people are allowed to eat. So a lot of the time, I don't know if you've had any experience of seeing clients where they fast. They go on fasting diets where they don't allow themselves to eat for like 6 or 7 hours at a time for God knows what reason. I don't no idea why they do this, but that's the rules that they have. And then there's the how much rules, which is when people set themselves a calorie limit. That calorie limit is pretty tiny. In my experience of talking to a lot of people that have calorie limits, they set the bar pretty low. So those rules, imagine having all the like hundreds of different rules, right? You're bound to break one of those rules, aren't you? There's going to be one rule that you're going to slip up on. But the interesting thing is when people slip up on the rules, that then triggers a chain of reactions. So when people break their rule, they feel ashamed of themselves. They think to themselves, I have completely ruined my diet. What is the point of me even trying anymore? I'm just going to go all out now and just binge on all my favorite foods that I've avoided. I'm going to binge on them because, you know what, I'm not in the mood to diet. I feel pretty low about myself. All my resources are drained. I can't keep on top of these rules. Let me just go all out tonight. And you know what, tomorrow, let's start again. Mm-hmm. I'll start fresh. But tomorrow, what I'm going to do differently is I'm going to go even harder and I'm going to go even stricter. So they're just stuck in a cycle. These people that develop these strict and inflexible diet rules, they are the characteristics that are most associated with binge eating problems. So the strictness and the degree of rigidity in the rules.
Yeah. And then I know that trauma has a role in this as well, because, you know, with the binge eating research, looking at people with a history of weight-based trauma, but also just trauma in general. From what I've read, that not separate from your research, but from what I've read about binge eating, there seems to be kind of two groups of people who struggle with binge eating. There's diet-induced binge eating, and then there's like pre-dieting binge eating that comes from things like trauma. Can you talk a little bit more on that?
Yeah. So with trauma, so just as a quick side note, trauma is definitely not my area of research, but I've seen a bit of it, and there are some theories as to why trauma affects or influences binge eating. And the main theory is that binge eating is a method that people use to cope. Mm-hmm. It's a method that serves as a distraction and a temporary escape from anything that's going on. So we often see that binge eating typically follows really intense negative mood states. When people are feeling incredibly depressed, incredibly lonely, you know, scared, frightened, that then is a very strong predictor of binge eating, you know, in a short time after that. So the theory behind trauma is that trauma, obviously by definition, is a traumatic experience, and it brings about a whole host of negative cognitions, negative emotions and things like that. So the theory is that people who binge eat do so as a means to escape that kind of traumatic experience they're feeling right at that moment. People explain, you know, reliving those traumatic experiences at one point in time, and it's kind of like that PTSD approach. So the binge eating for them serves as a useful tool to get away from that trauma a little bit and just remove themselves from that situation. But unfortunately, binge eating isn't a healthy coping strategy. So that's what we try to do. We try to, you know, when we use psychotherapy for binge eating, we try to help them develop a suite of more adaptive coping strategies that doesn't involve food and doesn't involve eating.
I love that. And I would say too, and I mean, tell me if you agree or not, but I think an important part of recovering from binge eating or even, you know, struggling with emotional eating is, yes, developing those healthy coping mechanisms that are outside of food that actually process the emotions and support the emotional state, and helping reduce the shame when binge eating does happen or when emotional eating does happen, because that shame is like keeping the cycle going.
Exactly. 100% it is. And it just fuels it. It just exacerbates it even worse. So, you know, we might not be able to get a person to stop binge eating forever. They may have a couple of slip ups here and there. The important thing is to view them as slip ups and not view them as relapse. They may have a couple of slip ups, but then the question is, well, all right, you've had that slip up. Now what do you do after that? What you don't want to do is go back to that all or none thinking approach where it's like, I failed, I went back to square one, and as a result, the cycle starts again. So what we also want to do is tell people that, yes, if you're in trying to recover and you're in recovery and you've slipped up, that's fine. What are the strategies you could use now to make sure that you don't fall even further back? So let's move on from that previous behavior or that previous episode. And let's again use our adaptive coping strategies to move forward and use it as a learning experience. So I definitely think that, like you said, we want to encourage people to not experience that shame And you know, the shame about what it might happen to their weight because they overate or they binged on an occasion, because that will just then continue to fuel that particular cycle.
Yeah. So what do you say about all of the sort of, because there's a whole, you know, group of books and approaches out there that I personally don't love. That approach binge eating from a just breathe through it, and also like how you address binge eating and lose weight, and like if you can just breathe through that urge. So what does the research actually say about that?
Yeah. Okay. So that's a good question, because like you said, there are so many different gurus out there that offer advice for binge eating. So what I will say is that I will preface this by saying we don't know the best. We don't have a panacea. So we don't have something that is a cure-all thing for everyone with binge eating. But what I will say is we've got good evidence to suggest that certain approaches are better than other approaches in tackling binge eating. And there is unequivocal evidence suggesting that a form of cognitive behavior therapy is our best approach for dealing with binge eating. So what does cognitive behavior therapy mean in this context? Well, basically it's composed of a bunch of, it's a treatment package, what we like to call it, that it consists of multiple different types of strategies designed to target binge eating. So your question is, well then, you know, what's your view on the breathe through it? Well, the way I think about, you know, breathe through it is, are you kind of getting at that meditation kind of thing? Is that where you're kind of coming from?
Yeah,
mindfulness and meditation. There is, with mindfulness and meditation, it's one of many tools that we could use to address binge eating, but it should not be used in isolation. I don't think there's any good evidence saying that if we use this in isolation, you know, someone's having a frantic episode of binge eating, just stay calm, relax, breathe. No. That's not going to address the issue, right? We need to have a whole bunch of things at our disposal to help this person. And, you know, one of the things that I like to do with what I like to, you know, kind of advocate for is activity scheduling. So what I mean by that is when people get an urge to binge, what we need to do is supplement that urge or try to ride out the urge by engaging in some form of distracting activity. Because urges are temporary. They peak and then they start gradually decreasing. So if we can get through the peak somehow, then we're well on our way to addressing the binge. And one way I like to do this is by getting people to essentially come up with a list of potentially distracting activities they could do. And mindfulness may be one of those activities for a particular person. That may be the thing that really forces them to think about or pay attention to something else in the moment rather than that urge. So if it's helpful for one particular person in riding through that urge wave, then so be it. But for most other people, it's not going to be helpful. So we need some other mechanism in play that can help them kind of get through that risky period of binge eating. So it could be anything. What I like to do and what I've, you know, heard is to be effective is, you know, if you're kind of anticipating an episode coming along, what's a great way to do that is via calling your friend on the phone. When you call someone on the phone and talk to them and have an in-depth conversation, you're not thinking about food if the conversation is hopefully the conversation is diverted to something else that's going on. So what people have reported is that once they get off the phone, you know, for an hour or so with their best friend or their mom or something like that, they realize that urge has gone. It's like anxiety. The urge just peaks and then it goes if you can get through that peak. So we need a collection of different tools at our disposal to help us get through that urge to binge eat. And mindfulness, breathing, may be one very small tool, but to kind of promote it as the tool is definitely ill-informed and is definitely not going to be helpful to people, in my opinion.
So I'm surprised, actually, that you are, though, a proponent of, like, the distract yourself thing, because I see distract yourself on, like, Healthline and all the other, you know, whatever, all those other websites that are kind of like, distract yourself and no. Yeah. Like, it kind of lists off things. I'm like, this isn't binge eating help, you know, but I personally struggle to recommend distract yourself to people early on, because I tend to fall in the category of I like unconditional permission with my clients. Like, I think that allowing yourself to binge and dealing with the shame in the moment and actually like working through the shame and healing that can be really effective. And it's a good sign of like that you're restricting. And so healing the restriction, obviously. And I recommend a distract yourself thing kind of later down the road. But I'm curious, because that seems to be one, a big recommendation that is used in sort of the CBT package. I know it's not the only thing. So I'm actually just like surprised by that. And I'm curious about it.
Well, yeah, I think the important thing is it's just one small component within a suite of things. And the purpose of those distraction-based tasks are to prevent the onset of an episode. It's not particularly useful if the person has done the binge and then what they're, you know, experiencing after that. We don't usually prescribe activity scheduling. That's what we generally call it. We don't usually prescribe that or recommend that for after the fact, so after an episode has occurred. We usually do that as a way to prevent an episode. The reason is people can usually predict when they're going to have an episode of binge eating. So if we're able to disrupt that usual linear sequence, if we're able to disrupt that by, you know, prescribing some activity-based tasks, then that could be a useful way in which people could stop one episode. You know what though, your comment, it's different schools of thought. Yeah. So there are multiple ways we can address the one thing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just the way that people kind of go about things, and that's one particular package that is set up to address binge eating. But then there are also other packages that use other approaches that say, you know what, don't avoid the emotions, because we know that if we avoid these urges and we avoid, you know, dealing with them, that's actually going to make things worse. So that's another theory, and that's based on that. It's kind of the newer generation of cognitive therapy, so that third wave, we usually call it.
Acceptance
and commitment therapy.
Yeah.
So there are multiple ways we can address this issue, and that's just one way in which we could do it. But there are also many other ways as well that can effectively address it. And what the important thing is, what we don't yet know is what works for whom. Mm-hmm. So what we don't yet know is what particular person responds to the unconditional permission, what type of person responds best to that, mm-hmm. and what type of person responds best to the distraction. Unfortunately, the research out there is we don't know yet. We're going in blind and going, right, this is what we've got at the moment. I'm going to try this on you and hope for the best. If it doesn't work, then I'll give the other thing to you. We need to try to work a bit harder to go, right, based on my knowledge, this is the thing that will work best for you based on what you're showing, what your client is presenting with, you know, in their first session, their assessment session. This will work best for you. And then you might have another client that comes in immediately after you with a different profile, a different demographic and clinical profile. And you go, right, this one will instead work best for you. But unfortunately, we don't know the answer to that yet. And that's actually what I'm trying to touch on with my research at the moment. So hopefully I'll be able to give you a better answer in the future.
Yeah, keep me updated. It's interesting. I mean, you definitely have me reevaluating some of the things, like the order in which I present things, because I mean, I'm literally about to go into, by the time this airs, I'll already be in it, but as of right now, I'm about to start a group program, and it's going to be my biggest group program ever, called Binge to Food Freedom. I am definitely reevaluating sort of when I share different bits of information based on what you just said, because you're right. I think that although most of my clients tend to, the unconditional permission thing tends to work really well, really effectively early on, it doesn't mean that in a group setting, that's always going to be the thing that's going to help. You know, group is so different from one-on-one.
So I'm
glad we talked about it.
And I think another important distinction is, so you're dealing with real life people here. And what I mean by that is, I'm talking purely from a research perspective,
right,
when things are done in a really controlled fashion. Mm-hmm. Whereas I imagine in your practice, things are unpredictable. You're dealing with people with multiple presentations, multiple comorbidities. Everything is just spiraling, you know, in every sort of direction for you. Whereas from my perspective, I'm looking at the research that, as I said, is done in a really rigorous and controlled fashion that is a step-by-step process. So that's also an important distinction to make as well, that sometimes research doesn't necessarily translate to real world.
Right.
So that's also important. And that just reinforces the fact that we don't have the right answer yet. And you know what? Experiment with your group in terms of, if you have a hypothesis when you think you should prescribe things, back yourself and go for it, because you've got experience in this space and you know your particular clientele. So back yourself and go for it. So it's just that, yeah, my point of saying that is it's important to be aware of the distinction between controlled research environments versus, you know, real world settings, because we come from different. So I come from a strong research, you know, controlled environment where, you know, you're in actively working with members of the community. So I just thought I'd throw that out there too.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And that actually leads me to my next question, which is, you know, what do you think, or what do you wish people understood about the limitations of research?
Yeah, it's funny you ask that, because it's exactly that. It's exactly the fact that sometimes research doesn't necessarily generalize to what goes on in the real world. And the reason is, in the real world, we're dealing with so many variables. We're dealing with so many different complex variables that we just can't control. With the luxury of doing research is we can control that. We can account for all of these different variables and really identify a cause and effect relationship. With research, we can say that intervention X causes people to stop binging. So X causes Y. In the real world, we can't do that because we haven't got control of those other things. So the biggest, you know, limitation of research is that, you know, sometimes, although we do our best, sometimes it doesn't necessarily inform what goes on in private practice. So we're trying, and there's a lot of ways in which we can try to mimic private practice. But the issue is then, what I'm trying to say is, the more we try to mimic the real world, the less stronger conclusions we can make about a particular thing. So we're really in a state of tension with research. So it just depends on the aim of the research. The typical way in which we want to do research, I'm just talking from an intervention or a treatment perspective, is we want to develop a treatment. We want to pilot the treatment on a few people in a research, just to see whether the people find it enjoyable, accepted, it's tolerated. Then when we've got that initial information, we want to then test it in a really big, what we call a randomized controlled trial. And the randomized controlled trial just basically allows us to state that my intervention caused people to reduce their symptoms. Because if we didn't conduct a randomized trial, we can't say that the intervention causes symptoms, because we've got no control about any other things. So then after we've developed that, then we try to mimic real world settings. So it just really follows a sequence of processes which we're going to take. But yes, unfortunately, sometimes research doesn't translate to the real world. That's why we need both practitioners, and that's why we need both researchers. So that's the beauty of both disciplines, I guess.
Yeah, I appreciate you explaining that, because I know it can be a little bit confusing for people, and especially practitioners online. We like to talk about the research. We like to, you know, all of this stuff, point out all these things, but what people, I think, don't quite understand is that even, you know, the gold standard of research for one thing, so randomized controlled trials, and it usually has participants who are like the most likely to succeed.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, it's these kind of perfect conditions.
Perfect.
But in that, you know, achievement of a perfect condition, are we achieving like real world? Is it real life? Can it be replicated outside by anyone? And will that actually be the situation? Will people be successful in real life if they're not in these environments that are like priming them to be successful? You know what I mean?
That's exactly right. And it's exactly right. And that's why practitioners should take an evidence-informed perspective, meaning that they've got the research, they know what works under the best and ideal conditions. How can they use that research to then inform their own practice? So we're certainly not saying to practitioners, you must do this in this particular way, do not deviate at all from the plan. We're not, certainly not saying that. What we are saying is that, you know, we've showed you what the evidence is. Maybe use that evidence to your advantage in the way in which you treat these particular people there. There's a long way to go, but but that's one of the biggest, it's one of the biggest conflicts we experience with researchers and clinicians, because the researchers always go, follow the plan, stick to the plan. And, and then the clinicians go, I can't, I deal with these complex people that aren't in your research study. And it's just a back and forth tension, yeah. which is quite funny. But yeah, so I certainly agree with that statement.
So is there anything else, just to close out? We didn't even talk about body image, but we don't have time to get into it now because that's a whole, you'll just have to come back. I hope that's okay. Yeah. But is there anything else that you want people to like understand about binge eating or you think we didn't cover?
Well, I think because we covered dieting and that and the role of dieting in binge eating. And like you mentioned, the other role is body image and that particular impact of binge eating as well. So what my take home message would be for people who kind of struggle with these issues is try your best to really identify or understand what are the kind of factors that are keeping your binge eating going. So what are the things that are maintaining your binge eating? And there are heaps of different factors out there that are maintaining the binge eating. So I'll just provide a couple of examples. And hopefully that people who don't have as much insight towards their particular problem, hopefully they can then reflect in their daily life of okay, what is it that is kind of contributing to my binge eating? Because that's the first step towards changing. That's the first step towards recovery. You need to understand what is kind of causing or driving it, because then the strategies that we use to treat binge eating is actually designed to target those factors that are causing it. Because the idea is that if we target those factors, then it knocks out binge eating completely. It will have a flow-on effect. So a couple of really key drivers of binge eating are, we already discussed dieting. A couple others include body dissatisfaction or what we call an over-evaluation of body weight and shape, which just basically means that people, equate who they are as a person or their self-worth entirely on what they weigh or what they look like. And that is very problematic for a number of reasons that I won't go into. But, basing your entire self-esteem on just your weight and shape is hugely problematic because, it's the thing that's also causing the dieting to begin with. And a couple other things are, really intense and abrupt negative mood changes. Inability to tolerate negative moods is a massive contributor to binge eating. And also, you've got to look at your interpersonal relationships. That's also a huge contributor of binge eating. So if you experience regular conflict with a spouse or with your friends or with, a colleague, also a massive contributor to binge eating. People who have really perfectionistic tendencies, so they need everything in order to one thing and they won't accept anything other than pure success because, those standards are so hard to achieve that they're almost always bound to fail. And then finally, another massive contributor is self-esteem. So people who have a low core general self-esteem, they just don't value themselves as a person. That is also a really huge contributor too. So people who are listening, if you're struggling with this and you just want some, you want to kind of help yourself, self-help tools, really first pinpoint, what is it? Have it, really reflect on it. Use a journal or something. Just reflect on what is it that is kind of contributing to my episode? What was happening leading on to that episode of binge eating? And if you're able to pinpoint that and you're able to pinpoint a pattern that's going on, then you are halfway there towards addressing your binge eating because then you can devote your time towards addressing those particular factors. I think that's my main take home.
Yeah, you basically just outlined my first week of my program. So perfect.
Oh, beautiful. Well, I'm glad you're evidence informed.
I am, yeah. Root cause is... without addressing the root cause, what are we doing? We're just putting
exactly.
Band-aids.
You're just
and
band-aid.
Trying to put fires out left and right, and it's just chaos.
That's it. Yeah. You've got to address the causes because that will have the long sustaining effect down the track.
Exactly. So I appreciate that. I think people will find that very helpful. I've talked in a previous episode for those who are listening about the four different, what I call the four different types of restriction. This definitely isn't like, you won't find this in the research, but I like to call them the four restriction.
Can you tell us?
Yeah. So mental restriction, I can't have this, rules, things like that.
Yeah.
So all the dieting mentality, I found even if you're not restricting physically, if you're restricting mentally, that can still continue to perpetuate binge eating. Obviously physical restriction, dieting, or food insecurity, whatever it is. Emotional restriction, so not being able to feel your feelings, not feeling like you're safe to feel your feelings, not knowing how to deal with negative emotions in a productive way, or just really stuffing them down and then putting food on top. Like that's, that one. And then restriction of fulfillment. So do you feel fulfilled in your life? Do you have self-esteem? Do you have, you know, a understanding of your worth? And if your life is very sort of narrow in terms of all you think about is food and dieting, and you're not really doing things that are fulfilling or have relationships that support you, then this is going to be a big thing. And if you're feeling really lonely and all this stuff, like that's going to contribute to it. So kind of targeting those four areas of restriction and identifying like, where am I restricting and how can I start to make my life a little fuller makes a big difference.
Well, that sounds completely what the research is showing, and that is all touched on in that CBT package that I was talked about. So I think I think that is an excellent strategy to take, and I'm sure that that will have a profound impact on the group of people that you're taking. So congrats! I want to hear the outcomes of that. That sounds.
I know.
Sounds
I'll
great.
Have to like actually be a real dietitian, track some things or something. I know that's what we're supposed to do. We were taught that in school of like, if you could develop a program, like track your outcomes. I'm like,
yeah, you have to. Otherwise, how do you know if it works?
I know.
So what you should do before the program starts, give each participant or client a questionnaire and then give them the same thing after the program and compare. Get them to compare their scores. You have to.
Okay.
You definitely have to do that.
Well, I'm going to email you for some
absolutely
for some questionnaire advice or because I know that there's validated ones, so I guess I'll that'll make my life a little bit easier. See, I'm all emotional and data boggles my mind, so to have you come on and explain the research is definitely saves me like hours and hours of sitting
here. That's good.
So I'm we can marry the two things. I do
absolutely.
The research, but it just takes like
and you know what, you need a particular type of person to do the research, like your standard scientist sitting behind a computer doing the typing. A lot of people aren't interested in that, and I understand because I look at myself sometimes and I go, what am I doing? I'm just behind a desk 24/7, go out in the real world. But no, we need those people and we need the practitioners like yourself. So we've got a good mix going.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate having you on and appreciate you explaining all of this stuff. I'm sure people will find this episode so helpful. And where can people find you?
Yeah. So, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm really glad I got to speak about this stuff, and I thought it was a great conversation about all things binge eating. So where can you find me? So give us a follow or just a like on Instagram or whatever at breakbingeeating.com at breakbingeeating. But I've also set up a website that highlights all of this stuff that we spoke about today. So the website is breakbingeeating.com. And it's just basically a bunch of different resources and self-help tools that are designed for people who are struggling with binge eating. So it's just information, essentially, out there on this stuff. And, there are a couple of opportunities there if you're interested in that. So give us a check it out if you're interested in learning more about this stuff.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much.
If you are loving the Trust Your Body Project podcast and are ready to dive headfirst into your healing transformation, head on over to whitneycatalano.com/food-freedom to learn more about working with me. whitneycatalano.com/food-freedom.